And if I can actually finish a 100-miler, then wow, I've done something. You know, it's like every time I can finish a race, it kind of proves to me that I'm not the lazy slacker that I imagine myself to be. And so it's almost like every race is a way to prove to yourself that you're better than you think you are, because I think we all negative on ourselves. Very few of us go around saying, you know what, I'm awesome. I'm really awesome, you know.
Welcome to the Trailhead of Trail Runner Nation, where we go on virtual trail runs with interesting guests that tell us some great stories and help us become better runners and possibly even better humans.
And today's guest is Dr. Gordon Harvey, and he tells a very inspiring story. In fact, it's just not his story, it's our story as the trail community.
He's going to get into some of the medical conditions that he had that could have easily made him take his shoes and hang them somewhere prominent in the garage and never lace them up again.
But importantly, he took good advice from his doctors, steered him in the right course, and now he's back on the trail. Listen to this interesting story on Trail Runner Nation.
Our friends at UCAN are offering a special deal this weekend only on Black Friday and Cyber Monday. That's November 22nd through November 30th. Instead of getting your normal 20% off, they're offering 30% off with the code TRN30. It's time to stock up.
If I was running on the trail with you and I had a bottle of UCAN, I would not stop talking about how great it is, how great it tastes, how well it works. And I've tried all of those drinks out there. I just love UCAN, and I know you would too if you just go out and try it.
From Edge energy gels to energy powders to the bars, it's a long, steady burn that's going to help you for hours and hours. Here's how you find them. Go to ucan.co/TRN. And for this weekend only, use that TRN30 to get 30% off.
Scott, did I mention how much I love the taste of UCAN?
You did.
Good.
One of our other valued sponsors that we just love the company is Jonji. They're in the middle of their third release for the fall winter collection. It's based on the American Southwest with artist runner Christian Gehring.
They look absolutely phenomenal, but more than that, they feel great and they work great. Whether it's their rain runner jacket, that's perfect for this time of the year where we are from, or it's the shorts, they both fit and work. I love them.
Durable, sustainable, responsible men and women's gear in just a lot of different colors. You can be your own runner and not look like everybody else out there.
When you look good and feel good, you run well, Scott. You know that.
You can get 15% off with the code TRN at jonji.com. That's 15% off with the code TRN.
Thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Don Freeman.
And I'm Scott War, and we are honored today to talk to Gordon Harvey, Dr. Gordon Harvey, I should say. He is a distinguished professor of history at the Jacksonville State University, and he's also a distinguished trail runner out on the East Coast in Alabama. And he has a pretty good resume of races. And he reached out to us, I think it was last week, and wrote a really good email about his experiences on his second attempt at a 100-mile race. And that's what we're going to talk about today, because there's lessons that we all can learn. He's been put in a position where we've all been, and I think it's good for us to talk about this.
Or where we may be going. So it's, right. You know, it's right. Foreshadowing our future, or looking back in a historical look. And in fact, part of your professorship is history. Is that true?
Yeah, that's right.
And which era are we talking about? This is so relevant to running, but I'm just curious.
Well, I started my career, I counted the other day, I've been doing this for 22, 23 years on the tenure track. And so I started my career writing about Southern politics and education reform, Southern governors in the 1970s and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I published a book or two on that. And then now I'm at the last third of my career, and there's no more promotions to get. I can't get any more raises. So now I've decided I'm going to write on whatever I want to write on. And so I'm actually writing a book about bike messengers in San Francisco, which is totally another universe than the Southern governors. I got tired of politics and I just wanted to do something crazy.
Well, I'd be very interested in that bike messenger story and what brings interest for you into that.
My oldest son went to college in the fall of 18, and he went to Middle Tennessee State University in Middle Tennessee. And it's a big campus, but he wanted to get a bike. So we bought a bike, and he's kind of like me in that he gets something, and then all of a sudden he wants to know the history of everything having to do with the thing you just got. So now he's like, I want to know the history of bikes. Are there any good bike movies? And so I'm talking to him about, you know, American Flyers, which was one of Kevin Costner's first movies, the Quicksilver, the Messenger movie from 1986 with Kevin Bacon, and there's Premium Rush. It has Joseph Gordon-Levitt that's in New York from 2013. And so then I started thinking, man, I'd like to read a book about bike messengers. And there's really no book about modern bike messengers other than those that have been done by some sociologists who did bike messenger for a summer and then decided to write about their experience. And to be honest, most messengers who are legit full-time messengers kind of make fun of those guys because they come in when the weather's good and the sun's shining and they say, come see us in January when it's raining and see how long you last. But so I decided I'm going to write a book. And San Francisco, I'd been there a lot. I have friends who used to live in the Bay Area. And it was San Francisco bike messengers who actually almost successfully unionized around 1999, 2000 before the dot-com bust. And to unionize messengers is harder than herding cats. And so that was there's a compelling story in there that there's a strip club, there's bike messengers, and there's the dot-com boost. So you can't beat that.
When that book comes, you've got to come back on this show because I have some questions down that path.
I think there's an episode in Trail Runner Nation about bike messengers. It might be a great cross training there. I mean, they take some risks out there.
it's a whole subculture, and it reminds me of runners, ultra runners, because we really do things in an unorthodox manner. We do things that people would consider dumb and dangerous. We take risks. We take pride in climbing mountains all day long and wearing things that people don't wear anymore, like Western buckles. And so there's a lot of crossover between that. So.
Hey, speaking of history, a short discussion before we hit record, we found out that Gordon is not only a history buff on bike messengers, but also in podcasts. Tell us a little bit about your history with podcasts, Gordon. We thought we were the first podcast to ever be published out there, but we find that we're not.
So back in late 2006, we were going to take our kids to Disney. I used to live in Louisiana back then. And the kids got the flu the week before we're supposed to go to Disney. And all I'm thinking is thousands down the drain because of the flu. And then one Saturday morning, I wake up with flush, fever, I feel lousy. So I go to the Saturday, you know, doc in the box. And they take my vitals six times and then tell me to lie down in a dark room. I don't have the flu. I've got stroke level high blood pressure because back then I was around 250 pounds on a 5'9" frame. And I'd been obese all my life. I'd even been as high as 262 at one time. And so I get on blood pressure medication. I lose 10 pounds automatically from fear of dying. You know, it just falls right off me. And so I start to look at what I'm eating. And then I realized that when I was in high school, the one thing that helped us cut weight in wrestling was running. So I decided I'd start running. So early 2007, I started running, did a mile, died. You know, the whole story that everybody does. I did a mile and I died, but I loved it. I did some 5Ks and I loved it. I did some 10Ks and I loved it. And then I set this huge goal to run a half marathon, hobbled through a half marathon, took me 3 hours, changed to do 13 miles in Dallas, Texas. And then I decided I was going to do the Disney marathon. We love Disney. I've been there during marathon weekend. People are clapping for you the whole time. It's a big festival. So I decided I was going to first blog about it. And this is 2007 blogging. And around October of 2008, I decided to start a podcast called Running to Disney. And it was essentially me talking about training to run the Disney Marathon. And so I started that in October of 2008. It morphed into another title called, once I stopped obsessing over Disney, I renamed it This Running Life, Stealing from This American Life. And I think it ran really through late 12, early 13, and I just lost steam. I mean, and there was this whole generation of what's called the Runcast, where we'd strap portable mics on us and talk while we ran. And Steve Runner of Fidipidations was sort of the godfather of the Runcast. And there was a whole crew of us that had maybe 200-300 listeners, and we all listened to each other's podcast, and I'd just ramble about the randomest crap you ever heard and talk about my training and how I didn't feel like a runner and I couldn't lose weight, or now I'm losing weight. I'm scared of, just the whole runner mentality. And I did that for a few years until I was just recording random stuff. And I realized that I don't think really anybody's having fun anymore. And so I just shut it down and disappeared, but it was fun while it lasted. And the cool thing is I met a lot of running friends across the country, and that's the magical thing about it is I wouldn't have known anybody around here, only a handful of people who ran, but I know scores of people who live in California, Colorado, Texas, Canada, across the ocean. It's amazing how this connects us together into this common experience and the same complaints and praises. And so it's like a big running family, and I don't regret ever doing it. And I kind of miss it actually sometimes.
Are those episodes still archived and available for download?
I stupidly stopped paying. I forget the service that distributed it. It was I can't remember now, but I stopped paying that and they got pulled off of iTunes, but I did upload them to archive.org. So they're all safely preserved on the Internet Archive.
I'd love to take a listen and see what that sounds like. And that's one of the things that Scott and I have tried to do is we just describe the podcast as sitting around a table on chairs, but having a run discussion, and those come so easy. And when you're done with the run, you say, that was such a fun conversation. And we're just trying to reproduce that with cool people like yourself. So thanks.
That's the magic, is that you ultra runners, unless we get to a race or have a regular group or by ourselves. I mean, I'm by myself all the time. I like the solitude. I got to be alone. I used to be a department chair here and I had to be away from people. I needed to break up with people for a while. So you don't really get to talk to other people about your fears and your anxieties and your hopes and dreams. And so when you listen to shows like this about the reality of trail running, you realize that you're not alone and that you're not a total loser, or you're not as good as you think you are. And it's exactly what we need for a solitary sport as ours.
One of the characters in the story that we're going to talk about today, besides Gordon, is the Pinote 100 mile trail race. That is one of the characters in this story. And for those people who don't know about the Pinote 100, Gordon, can you tell us a little bit about this character?
It's a trail. It's a national recreation trail, NRT, that runs from North Georgia to Sylacauga, Alabama. It's, I want to say 350, maybe 400 miles. And it's a beautiful single track trail. There's some hellacious mountains on it. Our local mountain is Chiha Mountain. It's the highest point in Alabama, which for some friends of mine in Colorado is, 2,600 feet doesn't do much for them, but for us, it's pretty high. And it's one of those trails that's really accessible and probably more accessible than the AT, because the AT gets super busy all the time, especially in the summer. And so you can do a hike through or even a run through of this trail, over a several week period. And there's small group of hikers and runners who just live on this trail. And it's virtually 30 minutes away. So it's my backyard trail. It's the home trail. It's the one my very first trail race was on this trail. And so it's like your first love. And it's a rugged trail. It's not those buttery smooth California horse trails that everybody used to run on the West Coast. It's rocks and roots and hills and mountains. And, you get to those little trails that have a steep berm that are about 12 inches wide and your right foot's hanging off and you're trying to get through. It's just, some of it's pretty gnarly and it's a pretty rough trail to try to run a race on. And there's several races on it every year.
For our California trails, it sounds like we've been getting quite a reputation of buttery smooth. But I'll tell you, Scott, it's rough when the rake marks from the morning trail groomers. You get some fresh trail with those rake marks. It's beautiful out there.
Yeah, it takes a lot of scarring with the leaf rakes that they and the brooms.
When I ran my first 50K, it was the Chiha 50K. It's on that trail. I ran it in 7:45. A friend of mine ran their first 50K out in California, and they did it in like 4:45:5. And we were, it's like, oh my God, what's wrong with me? And then then you see the race pictures, and it's like there's people busting knees on our rocks, and then you see these 6 foot wide, and it's not all trails. I like to pick on, I love California, and I wish I lived there, but I like to pick on those wide, smooth, I can run this whole race trails. And I'm just like, come out here. Come out here for a little while.
we don't mind that. It's just fun to be able to toss some terms like that around. So we've set up the race course, and you've run that one before, right? Let's kind of set the story. You raced this in the past.
So, yeah, my first 100 was a 100 called, it's a small local 100 called Lake Martin 100. It's near Alexander City, Alabama, central Alabama. And a good friend of mine who runs races up in Birmingham, it's a private land. It's a four-loop course, four loops, 25 miles. Two aid stations that you see in this rotating figure eight. And it's really convenient for a first time 100 or if you don't have crew. Mm-hmm. And the trouble with loop courses is that every loop you're reminded how close you are to just stopping and going home.
Right.
There's your car.
Right.
So by the time you get to the third and fourth loop, it's just a mental exercise to just not look at any type of person relaxing or having fun and just keep on going. So I finished that. It was my first. I got through it. I was proud. And that was 2016. And I kept thinking, okay, I should do another one. So I thought I would do the Georgia Death Race in 2017. And I timed out of that. I didn't take it seriously. I just didn't understand how gnarly the North Georgia mountains would be. In 2019, I came back to Pinotti and I said, I'm going to run it. I'm going to finish it. I'm going to get the buckle. I've got to get it. It's my local race. It's a Western States qualifier. One of these days, I'd like to be in shape enough to even think that I could consider maybe even starting Western States, much less finishing it. Because I think if you're going to get a ticket to Western States, if you're going to get into Western States, you've got to appreciate and understand what you're about to try. And that if you don't take it serious enough and you're not ready for it, then you're really insulting those who are ready that didn't get in. And it's a burden to bear. And so mm-hmm. you better be ready to race. You can't just waste an entry because that's probably your one and only. So Pinotti's been a qualifier for years. And so in 2019, I decided I was going to race it. And I'd had some personal problems, this stressful job. There was a job I wanted that I didn't get. My kids are leaving the house. I'm a depressed dad, in the mid 50s, all the stuff that, guys are facing. So I phoned in my training, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. I cut my long run short. I 19 was great when I should have done 30. I'm doing some weight. So that makes up for it. All the crap we tell ourselves when we don't want to run 30 miles. And I missed a cutoff at mile 35. And I knew it. And by the time, I was 20 miles in this race and I knew it wasn't going to end well. And I when you start, either I've got a shot or this is not going to be good, mm-hmm. And then you should, sometimes I wonder if you just shouldn't just walk away then, but you got to try. And so I timed out of the race then. I was disgusted with myself. I knew I'd blown it. I knew that I didn't take it seriously. And, I took a year off. When I'm not racing, I try to do race photography for the local companies that just can't afford to hire somebody. So I give the races the photos away for free, and I just ask for race credit, and it's that's worth more money than I would get if they gave me cash, really. So
So
I just give free photos for race entries, and so I cashed in some credit for this year to try to redeem myself from 2019. But yeah, this was my second attempt at Pinotti and my third attempt at 100.
And so you've recommitted. You had a 2019 where you phoned in your training and realized that wasn't the right way to go. So there's got to be a different way. How did your training go up to the 2021 race?
There were several things. I was a department chair here for 13 years. And department chairs at universities, we have very little power because their tenure sort of insulates faculty. You have no authority other than, the power of persuasion, but you do get a lot of stress and complaints. And nobody ever came to my office saying, hey, you're doing a great job. It was always to complain. And that just wore on me for 13 years. And so I decided this summer that I was just going to, I'm stepping down. I'm going to go back to being a professor. I'm going to have fun at my job again. And the stress level went down 100%.
Nice.
I feel like a brand new human being. And last November, not to bury the lead, I had a heart attack. So I had shot Pinotti photos the weekend before, and inspired by all these people who were finishing, I said, I'm going to go to the track on Monday. I'm going to work on my speed. I'm going to get going. And I think I'm going to do Lake Martin in March, which was in the spring. And so I did a track workout and ran 4 miles on the track, did some 200s, nothing crazy. I got home and I was destroyed. The next day I tried to run again and I kept thinking, this pain in the center of my chest, this heartburn, I've never had this heartburn before. And so I ran and then I rode my bike to pick up my truck at the shop. And then by the time I got to this auto shop, I was covered in sweat and had to sit down. And a friend of mine who's studying to be a nurse, named Megan, she said, I think you should go get an EKG. And I did. My GP said, get to the hospital and don't drive. And they put me under. And then I woke up with three stents in my widowmaker artery.
Wow.
So I was that close. And I credit ultra running for strengthening my heart to actually get through 2 days of cardiac arrest. And it wasn't a movie heart attack. It was just slow burn, you know, where you talk yourself out of it. And after I got that, I said, I've got this second lease on life, or actually a second chance after the high blood pressure. I'm going to run 100 in March. This is November. And I'm telling the nurses, I'm running 100 miles in March. And they look at me like, wow. Oh, you're so cute. That's so cute of you. The more I thought about it, I was like, yeah, that's kind of pushing it, I think. And so I did a 27 miler in March, which was just hard as hell coming back from that. But after I got through that, I said, you know, I got to take this seriously. I don't want to feel like a loser every time I go to one of these long races. You know, I can struggle through 50 Ks, but the 100, you got to commit. And it's just, I'm going to do it this time. I'm really going to commit. I'm going to run all my runs and follow the plan.
I'm so curious about how you process your heart attack in your mind as a runner, because hey, almost every hard run I've done, and most of them are hard, your mind starts to talk to you a little bit. And if it's a heart, you might say, well, is this worth pushing up this hill? Should I back off a little bit? Is my heart rate higher than it should be? Am I making a dumb move? How did you process this and manage that?
The first 2 weeks coming home from the hospital, so the last part of November after I got home from the hospital, I had made the mistake of Googling stents. Don't ever Google science. Don't ever Google anything medical. And there, the first article I saw was stent failure rates. And I was like, For 2 weeks, I was like, I can't move suddenly. I think I should have people help me get out of bed. I don't want to like shake it loose and die. And I really thought for 2 weeks that I might die, even with these stents. And then I talked to my doctor and they were like, oh, you got to calm down and stop reading the internet. And you're on medication. It's not going to let your heart rate get too high. We're controlling your blood pressure and we wouldn't let you do any of this if we didn't think you were okay. And the sort of the negative byproduct of this medicine was my heart rate couldn't get too high. And so try to run hills where your heart rate can only get to like 90. Everything shuts down. So it was really hard. But the more I ran and didn't die, the more confidence I had that I probably wouldn't die. And this summer I had my 6-month checkup treadmill test and my cardiologist, who I chose because his spouse is an iron distance triathlete and he gets it. I said, listen, this is what I'd like to do. And he says, well, let's get through the stress test. And if you do well, you're clear. And so I did. And that stress test is harder than any race I've ever run. I don't know if you've ever done one, but you start off really slow. And in my mind, I was like, I should tell the nurse that I'm an ultra runner and you can probably speed it up. I'm in pretty good shape here. You know, I know I've had a heart attack, but I've done some pretty serious stuff. By the time I even got that thought processed, she had sped it up and I thought I was going to die. And I was like, I'm glad I didn't brag to her about how great I am, because it was like 8 minutes and my heart was shooting through the roof and they were like, hey, you're doing great. And I'm just like, I think I'm dying. Yeah. So I got the clearance to go. And once I knew that when I got to this max heart rate and didn't just blow up, I could probably pull the ultra off.
Gordon, I want to know, between November and the operation and running the 27 miles in March, did you tell your doctor that you were going to run a 27-mile race in March?
Well, I told him in the hospital I was going to do 100, and he just looked at me, you know, in that way. And once I had a follow-up meeting, and I said, listen, I'm doing this. I'd like to do this in March. How far do you think I can go? These are the options, 27, 50, or 100. He says 27. You know, and take it easy. And so I just did the 20. So I figured, and it was hard. It was harder than I really ever thought it would be, because the medicine was keeping everything from, you know, the heart can't pump the blood. The legs feel like bricks. I mean, I was already getting DOMS and I was halfway through the race. You know, it's not a good sign, but it's just the medicine and all. But yeah, it was this is what you can do. Let's see what happens and we'll come back and reevaluate.
I wonder, as you're talking about doing these hill climbs and training at the lower heart rate, I wonder if that was a benefit for you. Because, you know, all the smart people we've talked to on the podcast say that most of the training that we do is at a much higher heart rate than it should be. It should be at those low heart rates. So this kind of may have forced you to train right.
I tried, and I think the doctor agreed with me, and I don't know if he really fully understood what I was saying, but I tried to equate this to altitude training, that a restricted heart rate in a Alabama spring with the heat and humidity was kind of like going up and depriving myself of the oxygen because the blood's not getting to where it needs to go and the oxygen. So, and he kind of got it. And I think once they put me on a different medicine that didn't do this, I felt really good. And I started extending runs, you know, because I was starting to get back into the 10 mile daily run, walk, shuffle type runs when I got off this medicine. So I think it did to a certain degree, but it wasn't pleasant when I was in the middle of it. I can tell you that.
I mentioned a bit ago about how this could negatively affect your mind as you're out there. But as I'm thinking about it, did you ever process it in the way that, wait a minute, I was running with restricted blood flow before, it's wide open now, and now I'm better and stronger. It's like reversing the clock 10 years. Boy, do I feel great.
The couple of years before the heart attack, I had felt like I was really dropping in terms of what I could do or how I felt. And I basically chalked it up to I'm in my mid-50s, and we know what age does, and every decade does this to your body. And I was like, I'm 54. It's going to get harder. It's not going to feel that great. And then now I realize that, yeah, like you said, I was running with, you know, a third of my heart blocked. And so now it's, you know, it feels vastly different. And it wasn't just that I was being a slacker or an old man or anything. It was the fact that this, you're right, the heart was plugged.
Yeah, note to self, go get a stent right away and see if that helps me out. I'm starting to slow a little bit. What's going on here?
I'm thinking you may have found a solution for me having a hard workout this morning, Gordon.
Everybody's had these voluntary stents.
Yeah, made by Nike or Hoka or Ultra.
I think we may be onto a business plan here, Freeman.
I got the new Hoka stent, and I've never felt better, you know.
Well, the maximum cushioning, they have a wider orifice than anybody else.
Yeah. Zero drop.
I think we are onto something. Yeah, so it's just, yeah, I realized that that I've been running and in a restricted state. It's almost like those movies where you see, you know, you get the star of the movie gets to the end of the movie, and all of a sudden they put everything together at the end, mm-hmm. and they realize that, you know, Kaiser Soze, whatever. And so I'm piecing the last 3 years of my life, looking back at what I just went through. And I'm like, oh, well, that makes total sense. Uh-huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So let's get back to the story. Midsummer, you have the stress test, looks good. Does a doctor give you the okay to say, hey, I think you can do the 100?
He called me up after he read the results, and he said, let's run 100 miles.
Oh,
that was his verbatim. Awesome. And I was like, I got the tingles, and I said, I'll bring you the buckle when I finish.
Oh, great.
And I'm about to tear up now, but yeah, it was just like, I'm back, right? Not that I was ever there. I don't think that much of myself, but I'm back, right? So I'm going to give this a shot, and I'm going to really do a job on it. And yeah, the clearance was like, okay, you're not going to die.
It's an identity. You got the identity back. You're questionable of whether you're a runner, and now you've been told that, yes, you're a runner. That's awesome.
I seriously thought, you know, am I going to be able to do anything other than hike the woods? Because the first few weeks out of the hospital, all I could do was short hikes and no running for at least a month. And then I had to go to cardiac rehab, and the nurses are fixing me up on all this stuff and letting me run 10 minutes, and then they just shut it down if I wanted to do more. And so I really was kind of afraid that I would never do what I had done before. And I would just be that guy who used to do the trail runs, who just walks around with his camera, and that, you know, poor, pitiful guy, you know. So
what kind of support did you have from family and friends? So the doctor said, go do it, but was everybody in your camp? And we don't want to call out anybody by name, but did you have some people that were concerned about your welfare?
Other than my mom, everybody was pretty supportive. I mean, My dad has been sick. Well, he died in March, but he had been sick for a long, long time. And so we didn't tell him I was in the hospital until I got out of the hospital and could tell him myself, because he would have just, you know. But, you know, my family was fine. As long as the cardiologist signed off, everybody was fine. And, you know, the rule was I had to buy a Garmin inReach and take with me on every run. And I had preset messages and then, the SOS button. I had to check in regularly. All's well, doing fine. The doctor gave me a nitroglycerin pill that I put in a little pill box and keep in my hydration pack. And then other than that, if I felt anything weird, I promised everyone that I would tell them that I felt something weird. I wouldn't, because this is not an ankle injury. This is not IT band stuff. Right. This is life and death. And so I promised that if I felt anything weird, I swear to God, I would tell. And so everybody was fine with that. And once I started getting into some longer stuff and checking in and all, they just kind of fell back into the rhythm that they'd been in before.
So a heart attack is the rationale for me to get a Garmin inReach. I'm just taking notes.
It's gift giving season is around the corner.
Well, I joke that, you know, if I don't have this, then how are you ever going to find my body? You know, so
yeah,
that's, and then they always said, don't make that joke. So, but yeah, I realize now that it's actually not a bad idea if you're a solo trail runner. It's really not a bad, because cell service is, you know, depending on where you are, hit or miss.
So, you get the okay. Doctor says, let's go run 100 miles. What does this do to your frame of mind and your motivation? How many months before the race do you have to train, and how did that look like? How did those months look like?
June 28th was the stress test. The race is on November 6th. So what is that? July, August, September, October. Really 4.5 months, maybe. Four months and a week. So I got to get ramped up pretty quickly. And then once I'm ramped up, I can kind of jump into it. And so I decided I was going to run a test run of a 50 in September. So I would build to the 50 in September, and then I would take a week off or recover, and then I'd build back to the 100, and that'd be my thing. And so I felt, now it's like you've been talking such a big game about how you're going to do this, and now you actually have to do it. There's no excuse. Mm-hmm. So you've got to, you know, next time just shut up and don't brag so much about what you're going to do. But yeah, now it's got, I really have to do it. And there was something about no more stress at work, knowing I'm not going to die at any second. That, and then realizing that few people get second chances at health after something like this. And so it's like, if you don't, and I actually, bought a little pendant that was a memento mori pendant, you know, it's like, remember your death. But the second half of that phrase is memento vivere, which is remember to live, remember your death. So you'll remember to live. And so that was my new motto. It's on my little road ID now. It's like, okay, you have a chance to go run. You have a chance to try to do something nobody else has done. Very few people have done. And so you've got to celebrate and have some joy in this journey. Otherwise, it's worthless.
I want to make a comment about stress, because you brought that up a couple times. And I think we've all had periods in our life where we've been more stressful than other times. And when I first heard about stress and the effects on the body, I kind of pushed it off thinking, toughen up, pull yourself up by your bootstrap. But, and then speaking to different people like Dr. Cucuzella and Sock Doc and Dr. Maffetone, talking about how stress plays such an important part to our performance, or how it can affect our performance. And then I've run with times like we all have, with some stress and without stress. And it's like dragging an anchor behind you. Stress is real, and it can be a reason. It may not be because you need a stent, like I'm thinking might be my quick solution, but there's stress in those arteries too when there's restriction. But just emotional stress is a burden.
Yeah, I did not know until after the fact. My friend Megan told me that stress actually does constrict the art. It actually has a physical effect on your heart. Mm-hmm. And for 13 years, you know, I got this job as a department chair, and I'm proud of the work I did, but for the past 5 or 6 years, I've been threatening to quit, but the money was good. And so I was like, I got to have the money. I got kids going to college. I'm a prisoner of this job. And that was an added level. And then you come in and all you are is essentially the complaint desk. and the troubleshooting guy. And it's just like all day long, it just accumulates. And then the last thing you want to do is go run. You just want to kind of crawl up and get in the fetal position and watch TV all day. Even though run is a nice stress reducer, but if you're carrying all that with you, it's hard to enjoy a run when you know it's just going to be bad there on Monday.
Mm. Yeah, thanks for sharing that.
Gordon has done such a great job about talking about stress and how it can affect not only yourself and your health and your racing, but also how it can affect your life. And now we're going to take a short break to tell you how you can reduce the stress in your life.
And make sure you stay with us after the break where we get into the details about Pinotti 100.
We want to tell you about Open. Open-together.com/TRN is where you need to go.
Open is a mindfulness studio designed as a new way to practice well-being.
Open blends music, sound, breath, movement, and visuals to bring you into the present moment. We talk all the time about trail and ultra running being a mental sport. This is one way to get control of and center that mind.
Well, life, Scott, that's not the trail. Life is a mental sport and you need to get engaged. And I know when anxiety comes around and stress comes around, all you need to do is drop into a mindful class or a mindful studio that you can achieve online and you can relax and get yourself centered again.
That's right, Don. There's no excuse. They have live classes. They have on-demand classes. They have a website that you can go to and they have a mobile app. You can get Open for 30 days free using the promo code TRN when you go to open-together.com/TRN. 30 days free, Freeman. You got to do it.
You know why it's 30 days free, Scott? Because we put your bank card on this account. So get out there and charge up Scott's account and get a free month.
We're in the training mode. You train and you run this 50 miler in September. How did that go?
Not well. I physically I was fine. I had issues with my gut late in the race. It's September, mid-September in Alabama. It's hot. I was doing fine until about mile 20, and I was coming into the aid station. I was actually hiking down a little hill to the aid station. And you know how we are with aid stations. We may have been hiking 10 miles before, but you got to run in the aid station to show people how strong you've been.
Of course.
Right? Absolutely. So I'm like, oh, I'm just going to run into this. I'm going to run down the rest of this hill. I'm feeling good. And I face planted onto a rock and the rock got into my rib. Oh. And so I had this semi bruised rib. So if I took a deep breath, it was like a pain. It wasn't broken. I think it was just like bruised. So I carry that with me for the next 10 miles. And then all of a sudden the heat started getting to me and I started getting sick and slowing down. So I got to 37, 38 and missed a cutoff. Although I will argue now that the sweepers were 12 minutes early coming out of the last aid station. So anyway, I think I could have soldiered on to finish, but I think the last 13 miles would have just been a vomit fest because the person who gave me a ride back to the car, we stopped a couple times. I got to my truck and I just sat next to the truck and it was just like, I couldn't stop. You know, it was just like one of those days, but it was a good learning lesson. It was a long, long run in the woods. I got 38 miles. It's The goal is the 100. So don't sweat it. You know, this thing's happened.
As we read through your race report, or at least your thoughts that you had sent over and you'd posted online, you used the term fluke. And I really identified to that of running your second 100 or to get your second buckle. You wanted to prove that it wasn't a fluke. And I identified with that so much because I know my second 100 was all about proving to myself that the first 100 wasn't a fluke. I wasn't a believer in myself after the first one. It happened.
Yeah.
I thought I was so terrified and determined that that's what willed me to the finish. And that reality would smack me right in the face on number two. And there's no way I could pull this off. So I was pretty certain there was a fluke waiting for me. And that's why I identified that. Scott?
Well, and I want to point out, Gordon is being very humble here, telling about, some failures. But he's an experienced ultra runner. Mm-hmm. He has like 55 races under his belt. He knows how to run. So with that in context, I'm super impressed with your attitude. It'd be very easy to go to this 50 mile goal, midway goal, and think, oh, I didn't make it. Did that play anything in your mind? And it doesn't sound like it did.
No, I mean, it's, if I think if I don't trip, because the rock and the rib slowed me down a good bit, and I would have stayed ahead of the cutoff. And then the heat at this part of the country, up until really October, it's a crapshoot. You may come out and be able to survive it, or, you know, some aid stations are look like war zones. I mean, it's just carnage, because the heat can get to you if you push too hard or don't hydrate enough or hydrate too much. I mean, we had a guy at that same race a couple of years ago had taken too much water, hyponatremia, and they had to take him to the hospital because he was too much on the other end. So that's why I used to just shut everything down from May to October or May to September and do short distances. Don't try to race, but if you're going to run a fall 100, you've got to train through the summer, and it's just, you've just got to learn how to survive. It's brutal. And so, yeah, it was, you know, don't fall down, try not to throw up so much, and you finish. So
I'm going to ask you, Gordon, what made you think that maybe the first one was just a fluke? Why did you use that term?
I think I am too negative about myself, and I'll admit that, but it's your first one. There's this motivating factor that you got to get your first buckle. Mm-hmm. There's no quitting until you get the first buckle. And then once you get the buckle, it's like, well, you know, I got a buckle. You know, I could, yeah, maybe I don't need to push so hard in this one. Or, you know, I've already done 100, so I've kind of proved it. It's like the first marathon. I mean, my first marathon took me 6 hours and 16 minutes in the Florida heat. But it was the first marathon, and I wasn't going to quit. And when I got to the finish line, I wept like a baby because I can't believe that I'd done that. And I, you know, I got emotional at the first 100 too, and I knew I'd get emotional if I finished this 100. But you get the first one in your belt, all of a sudden the motivation of getting the first is gone, and you've got to find a new way to push through the dark period to stop that excuse for quitting, I think. And that's, you know, fluke is kind of harsh, but that's kind of the way, you know. This is going to sound really unfair and totally incorrect, but it's almost like I figure anybody can do something once. And so if you do it twice or three times, then to me, it shows that you can do it, you know, period. And to me, the first time, you know, it's like everybody can try something once and do it, but to do it 2, 3, 4, and, you know, I've got friends who've done 5, 6, 7, 10, 12. I mean, all they do is hundreds every month. And I'm just like, how in the world do you guys do this? I mean, it's like they're my idols, right? Yeah. And, you know, I've got friends who have so much grit that I just want them to sort of just ooze some out so I can steal it, you know, and, you know, rub it into my skin, because it's like, I don't know how you people get so tough. And it's just practicing being tough and not accepting the reason to quit. Like until recently, I was looking, you know, I'd get into these races and you'd look for the reason to justify why you don't want to keep going. Mm-hmm. And you'd find yourself subconsciously slowing down, thinking, you know, the sweepers have to be behind me somewhere. And, you know, I'm just going, oh man, I got swept and I don't know what happened. But subconsciously, you just wanted to go home. And those are the things that I've been fighting with for 3, 4 years. And I just don't remember doing that before 2016, 2017. And I feel disgusted about that and embarrassed, because I have, you know, we have an opportunity to do these things that few people do. And I've been taking it for granted, honestly.
Gordon, those are such great, great words. And they resonate so perfectly with the way I think about things out there. And I think that most of the listeners, if they're honest with themselves, have these conversations in their own heads too. So I think I'm almost embarrassed to say, I think collectively, we feel comfort in hearing that someone else is vocalizing these things that we only internalize. So thank you for that.
Yeah, it's almost like mental health issues these days. Nobody wanted to talk about mental health issues 10, 20 years ago. Now everybody's talking about their issues, and we realize that, oh man, I'm not alone, you know. And I even hesitate to guess that even the elites, the Walmsleys of the world, still, you know, they do have their doubts and fears. And I've got to imagine that at some time, Courtney DeWalter gets up on top of the mountain and says, man, I think I suck. You know, they've got to have these days. They're not robots, you know, but sometimes they're not allowed to share this stuff because you have, you know, they've got this role to play. And I think that that's sometimes unfair to them, but it is nice knowing that we all struggle. I mean, that's part of it, right?
But Gordon, they only have to suffer for 14 hours, and we have to suffer for 30 hours. So we're twice as tough.
know.
Well, you know, Gordon, you made a good point in your email to us that we don't see the struggle, right?
Yeah.
We don't see Courtney grimacing. The only pictures we see is Courtney smiling ear to ear.
Yeah.
She has such a great smile, and it's fun to take pictures of her when she's smiling. And so I think that we're fed half-truths, if you will.
Yeah.
We don't get the full picture.
I kind of equate, and I've subscribed to both of these magazines, Trail Runner and Ultra Running, but most of those covers are triumphant and victorious and celebratory and perfect. And they're almost like the fashion magazines and Young Women, where you have the perfect woman who's been photoshopped into perfection, that now this young woman has an awful body image because she thinks that's the way things should be. And we're conditioned to see Courtney floating across the finish line, cheerful and happy. And they won't do it, but I'd love to see them have a cover where they talk about the reality of trail running and show Walmsley taking the wrong turn, or DeWalty throwing up, you know, whatever she ate after the aid station. Just some reality to show us that everybody struggles at some point, you know, and like you said, their struggles are a little shorter than ours, but they do. So it'd be nice, you know, truth in running episode or issue.
You also shared in your email about how all posts, Facebook, Instagram, wherever you're going, they're all showing us the front cover of a magazine. Mm-hmm. Here's my glorious, triumphant defeat of this obstacle. And then we're constantly comparing ourselves against all of these images that are always pushed through our feeds.
Yeah.
And it makes us feel like, you know what? I must be the only one this is happening to, because everybody else seems like they're having a great time.
I mean, I didn't share with you guys the race photos that show all my fat lumps. I mean, I showed the ones that, you know, showed me looking svelte coming off the trail, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
And when I posted what I did on the race Facebook page, there were a lot of people who were like, man, you know, I did the same thing last year. I'm glad to know. Because all you get are 14 part how I conquered the race Facebook post. And you don't get the, it all went south and this is why and this is what I'm doing next. It's hard to admit defeat in this type of society that we've created.
Well, that's why these races are so important for us, whether we're racing or whether we're volunteering, because we see the agony of defeat. We see somebody that's sitting at the side of the trail with their hands on their knees, losing everything that they have in their stomach. Or we see somebody laying down on the trail in the fetal position. And so it's not all the pretty pictures. We actually get to experience that, whether we're volunteering or racing. And so I think it's good for us to get out there and see that and give us a dose of reality.
When I do my race photography, when I'm not running, I don't do the finish line stuff because they have family there. They're going to get their photos. What I do is I get at the toughest part of the course and I stand there as they're coming up, throwing up, spitting, cussing, crying. I go at the Cruel Jewel in Georgia a lot, Cruel Jewel 100. That place, that race is a monster. And on the second day, I get some of the best human carnage shots that show even the most front-running elite runner splayed out on the ground, wondering if they want to even go the next 20 miles to the finish. And it's that; those are the photos that get me going, because I, you know, it's like I said, everybody goes through this, and if they're going to go through it and they can push through it, then maybe I can. But that's the, you know, the honesty of what we do, and that, to me, that's the victory, is actually that you can go through that junk and actually get up and run even another mile. That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to get to the end of this Pinotti 100 soon, but I've got to ask you this question because you're a thinker, and I'm interested in your thoughts. Why do you think we even do this? Why do we reach for the hard, and why do we you know, promote the stories about just the carnage and the chaos? Why do we do that, do you think?
I saw the cover of a magazine where somebody was smiling. That's why I do it.
Good point.
I'll tell you why I do it. I started running longer and longer because I consider myself inherently lazy. I consider myself easy to quit. I consider myself very easy to lose commitment. And if I can actually finish a 50K or a 50 miler or, you know, a 100 miler, in my lazy state, then wow, I've done something. You know, it's like, can I actually push myself beyond the discomfort that it requires to do some of these races to actually finish it? And every time I can finish a race, it kind of proves to me that I'm not the lazy slacker that I imagine myself to be. And so it's almost like every race is a way to prove to yourself that you're better than you think you are, because I think we all negative on ourselves. Very few of us go around saying, you know what, I'm awesome. I'm really awesome. You know, if they do, then I don't want to be around them. Right. But most of us in our honest periods are like, I really suck. And I look like awful when I'm running, and everything jiggles and it's hard. And I just want to watch TV, you know? And so if I can do that and push through it, then maybe I'm better than I think I am. And it's like empirical proof that I am. And I know it. People tell me. You know, my friends tell me, my family tells me, but until you can actually tell yourself, it doesn't really resonate, I don't think.
Boy, I love the answer.
It's certainly not for my sponsors, let me say that.
So, Gordon, you show up and they have a bib for you, and you pin that bib on. How are you feeling before the gun goes off? Do you feel prepared?
This was the question I got. You know, everybody's like, how do you feel? How do you feel? And I told them, and this is the honest truth. I said, it's amazing what actually following a training plan does for your attitude. Because I'd followed it. I'd done my three big long runs. I'd, you know, committed to strength training. I'd done my David Roche mountain legs routine. I'd done my core. And I showed up thinking, all right, I've done everything I can. I feel good. I can, for the first time in years, actually see me finishing this race. I can see me cruising down the trail. I can see myself chatting with the aid station. I can see myself with a headlamp at night, walking down the trail, trying to eat a sandwich. I honestly saw it all. I mean, for the first time in years, I visualized success, and I haven't done that in years. And I was like, this is going to be a good day. And that's what I told him. I said, it's amazing what a training plan that you follow does to you.
Then the gun goes off. What happens?
The first mile and a half of this race is the proverbial conga line that drives me nuts. And in the past, I've gotten in the back because I'm like, I'm a slow runner. I need to be in the back. And I'm always behind people who are really taking it slow early on. And I get frustrated, and you try to pass on the single track and all. So this time I got in the middle, and I held a good, decent pace for me, 16, 15 and a half early on. And I just stayed with a group that I'd never run with before. And I felt good. I was running easy on the flats. I was climbing strong. I was chatting. We were joking. I was like, wow, I haven't felt this good early in a race in a while. And so I was doing everything I wanted to do. I was eating my gels. I was drinking my water and my hydration drink. I was right on. Everything was right. And I was like, I haven't felt this way in a long. It's going to be a good day.
Nice.
Yeah, right?
Nice.
Yeah. And I've been at the end of that conga line, and they start like this. The person is wearing a hydration pack, but they haven't burped the air out of it, so it sloshes. And it's in perfect rhythm with the bell for the bears that aren't even out there on the trail. And then they have their stuffed animal with a little heart on it that's holding on with a zip tie that dangles back and forth. I've been behind that person.
I know, Don, and I told you I was sorry.
I know. It's all right. Sorry, I was going to use your name, Scott.
And early on, everybody's chatty. And early in a race for me, I don't want to talk to anybody. I just want to get going. And, you know, early on when you're just kind of stuck in that line, everybody's just chatting and getting to know each other. And I'm just like, get me out of here. I don't want to talk. You know, I never talk in training. I'm not talking now, you know, so. Yeah, those are frustrating, but
I'm gonna finish up on my person with this bell on their back, because I asked to get around on your left, and the embarrassing part is some miles later they pass me. And so, you know, really should learn my lesson and put up with the slosh.
Every race that I'm in has this really old guy who's like carrying a water bottle and a pair of sweats, and you're like, oh man, this guy's going to die. And then, like, you know, 30 miles later, this guy's chugging up the hill while we're all throwing up.
We've all seen that.
I didn't mean to interrupt your story. So you're in the middle of the conga line. Things are feeling good. You're talking and having a great time.
Yeah, no, I feel good. The only problem I had was I filled my bladder the night before, the vest, and I didn't like test the tube. And so I went to get a swig of water, and I was like, there's nothing there. I was my tube cramped or whatever. And so I'm running with one hand behind my back, trying to squeeze it out. And then I get to the aid station that I was just going to run through. The first aid station, I was just going to cruise through, gain some time. I didn't need it. I had all my stuff. I planned on, you know, the next one. And so I take my pack off, and I realize that the new tube that I had bought has this little twist lock. And
oh,
it was
yeah.
locked, and I was an idiot, really, for about 7 miles. I was an idiot, and then I realized nothing was broken. So, but that was the only burp of the whole thing. And then I took a little fall, like we all do. But I felt good. I felt good, and it was just like a weird feeling to feel good and feel hopeful. Mm-hmm. And I told myself, I'm going to be in the mile I'm in. Don't do math. Don't look ahead.
Right.
The only planning you do is for the next aid station and what you need or what you're going to do. That's don't look ahead. And I have to have that conversation every so often. But I was able to stick to it.
I'm on Team Gordon right now. I'm feeling good about this, how you've set this up.
I've latched on to you, Gordon. I'm following you, man. I'm right on your heels because you know what you're doing.
Gordon, you say, how's the pace back there? Am I holding you guys up? And we go, no, we're perfect. Just keep doing what you're doing. You're setting a nice pace. That's Scott and I behind you right now. Sorry about the burping, sloshing.
Yeah, right.
I've got going on.
So how long does this last, Gordon?
So I get through. The first aid station I really stop at is around mile 13, and I see my crew, and this is where I made the first fateful decision. Well, the second fateful decision. The first one was to consume an extra gel per hour. I had been doing 2 per hour during training, and then somebody said, you should probably think about more calorie intake early on. So I was doing 3 over 70 minutes, and I hadn't trained for it.
Mm.
And that comes back to haunt me later, because it's just too much early that my belly's not ready for. And so at the 13 mile aid station, my crew chief says, listen, I got the sandwich. You want the sandwich? And my plan was to gel till I get sick of gels, Roctane, liquid calories, and then later in the day, start doing the solid stuff, the quesadillas, the sandwiches, the stuff from the aid station. And that would get me through the night. And then whatever happened overnight, I just eat what I could. I should have taken the sandwich because I felt good and I was hungry. But I told myself I didn't need the sandwich till later. But that sandwich, I think, would have turned the tide because it wasn't a sugary gel. It was a sandwich with some cheese and some mayo and some bread. And it was exactly what I think I would have needed then to sort of get me over that gel overload and get me through the middle part of the race. And I think that's where it all started to come loose because I was just doing too much gel, too much Roctane, and it was just too much sweet. And it caught up with me.
Nutrition's so important, right? If you're off there, it doesn't matter how much training you've done. It doesn't matter what your mental chatter is. You've got problems to solve. The fueling is off. Your race is off. That's got to be on.
I got to a point where I wasn't fully nauseous, but whenever I tried to chew something, it was right there waiting to happen, you know? And so you really just can't go crazy. And so after about mile 27, there's a stretch from 27 to 40, which is a lot of up and down. And then you climb the top of the mountain, the big mountain, and then you go down the mountain. And if you don't have the calories already in before that, you're not going to get them during it. And it took me 2 hours to eat like 20 vegan M&Ms. And it was nowhere near what I needed. Yeah, all I could do was barely like put it in my mouth and chase it with water really quick. And by the time I got to the top of the mountain, it was, all of a sudden my legs are starting to get heavy. They're getting sore. You know, all the systems are starting to go into the red zone. And by the time I got to the mountain, I was in trouble. So that was mile 40. So I've got another, 12 miles to struggle through before I end up dropping. And so it's essentially getting to the aid station and getting my pacer at mile 45. And I was like, okay, I got a pacer. She's got a sandwich. She's going to make me eat. We can pull this off. And I was 2 miles into that section and I just knew I couldn't, she gave me this quarter of a sandwich and she was in front of me. And so I was fake eating it because I just didn't want to eat it. So and I'd spit it out and end up throwing it out in the woods. And yeah, I ate that. I ate it. I'm good. And I just couldn't do it. And so, and she knew it. she was really, she's a really good pacer, Pam, and she was optimistic. She was like, oh, what are you going to do, you know, when you get the buckle? You think we should all get a group picture? Do you have a belt already? All these things, perfect stuff, right? Perfect pacer talk. And then it was also, okay, we're going to run here. We're going to run here, this section, you're running. And it's like, I'm just shuffling ground. And she's like, you're doing great. You look great, you know? And after about a few miles, she knew, she stayed optimistic, but she knew it was over because I was whining. I was whining and complaining. And I'd try to step over a stump and trip. And I was just like, you know, cussing. And I was the worst toddler you've ever run with. And she knew it. And, we got to mile 52 aid station, and I had 3 minutes to get out of the aid station before they were going to cut me. And I told her, I said, I can't do it. I mean, I want to, but I can't do it. I mean, it's going to be hard to get to the, because the next one was only like 4 miles away. It was the really big aid station. And I was just, I can't do it. And so, you know, they gave me the typical, you know, don't regret it. Are you sure? And she said, is this a decision you can live with? And I said, it is. It is. I can't finish this. I can't get to the next, you know, aid station without being cut. And I've had a good day, and it's time to call it quits. I'm not going to finish this race.
Gordon, what if pacers were brutally honest? I mean, their nature is to be super optimistic and supportive and probably the best, you know, liars on the planet when it comes right down to it in some certain circumstances, right? What if they were brutally honest?
Well, Pam, my pacer for this race, was the happy, positive, you can do it person. And Megan was my friend Megan, really good friends. She came out for Lake Martin, and she was my crew and pacer. And she is really good and encouraging until I start to whine and act like a baby. Mm-hmm. And that I remember vividly, I was like the mile 85 aid station. She put me in time out at the aid station. She said, I want you to sit in this chair and think about your attitude, and I'm going to go wow. over here and get some food. And it was, I mean, I was, you know, and I, you don't make Megan mad in the middle of a race. Nope. And so I sat there and I just was like, you know, man, I don't know. This is my race. What do you care? Just get out of my, I'm an adult. I'm a man, you know? And then she went off and hung out with the aid folks and came back. She said, you ready? I was like, okay, yeah. And then we finished the race, but it was the tough love I needed, man. But yeah, I was just, I think Pam could have slapped me around with a stick, and I don't think I would have, you know, that was more a physical thing. The first one was a mental thing. I'm tired. I've got a blister. This sucks right now, you know, and she's like, you know, just go get your attitude right. Go sit in a corner.
Yeah, pacers are amazing. They're great. And I don't mean anything negative about that. I think they're masters at changing mindset, yeah. And they're so important.
I've done it before, and it's hard. I'd rather be the runner. Because there's a lot of pressure on the pacer. And if you don't want to let them down, but you also don't want to, you know, drive them into the ground. And you also don't want to take it too easy where if you're tired and they're like, oh, I want to quit. And you're like, hey, that's a great idea. Let's go get a beer. You know, you've got to be committed and disciplined. And that's a hard thing to do as a pacer. It's a thankless job, really.
In Europe, they don't have pacers like we do here. I wonder if runners... I only ran over there once, so I don't know. There's plenty of people with much more experience. But as we're talking on this podcast, I wonder if fellow runners step up and become pacers for one another in different ways than we do here.
I think they do. Mm-hmm. I mean, you look at our races, there's groups of people who gravitate mm-hmm. to each other and just stick yeah. it out through the race. Mm-hmm. People who didn't have a crew or pacer, and they end up just falling together and they do it themselves. I think we've got to have... In the middle of a struggle, we've got to have somebody to share it with. Mm. And to me, that makes us stronger as friends and companions.
Right. Scott and I have had a chance to announce some races. And at the end, they all come in just groups. Just here come another six. And then it's quiet for a while. And then here come another four. It's just people yeah. team up and they pull through yeah. and do it together.
Yeah. I mean, that's the beauty, the beautiful part of this. I've done triathlon. And I've done marathons, and I'm not dissing on either of those, but you do not see the type of companionship. I mean, I don't want to overstate it, but I've seen people who abandon their races for someone who's hurt or sick. Mm-hmm. They just yeah. like, I feel great today, but this person needs help and I'm giving it up. And that makes me want to cry, but I'm giving it up for this person, get this person to safety. And God almighty, they deserve a medal for that stuff, man, because that's the total selflessness. But you've trained for months for this and you're abandoning it for someone else. And that's, I don't see that regularly in any other sport.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Where there's risk, there's camaraderie. Go ahead, Scott.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gordon, you're sitting here a couple weeks, a week after Pinotti. Where is your mind now? You started saying, I want to make sure that this first 100-mile finish is not a fluke. I trained my butt off, followed a training plan, felt great, and it didn't come together on race day. Where are you today mentally?
I see everybody's buckle pictures, and I see their race reports, and I see the group photos, and I'm just so incredibly jealous of that feeling because I wanted that group photo with my people. But I had a good day in the woods. I ran the race I wanted to until it went south. I did everything I could to bring it back. I couldn't. And so I had the courage to quit and not either make myself sick or injure myself. So I'm good with what happened, although I would much rather have finished. And then that night I was like, well, just maybe this is not the race for me. Maybe this is too difficult. Maybe I need to find something that I can finish and just give up on Pinotti and just become the race photographer. And a couple of days later, I was like, no, hell no.
Right.
And so I posted another thing on the race site and I said, you know, when I DNF'd, I thought I just needed to give this race up. It's too difficult. And then I realized that I want that buckle. I need that buckle and I'm not going to quit until I get it. And so I'm running it again next year. I've already, announced whatever that I'm doing it again. And I'm actually going to do Lake Martin in the spring. You know, I'll finish Lake Martin. I know I can, barring any injury or something. I'll get one under my belt, so to speak, to say, okay, here's the second one. You're not a fluke. Mm-hmm. And so now you're going to go in and you're going to tear yourself up over the summer and you're going to get Pinotti and you're going to get that buckle and you know how to eat now. I mean, it's like I learned how to train. I learned how to commit. Now I have to learn how to eat. And so once I get them all three together, I think I'll be fine. And so then there was a bunch of people who resonated with that. They were just like, yeah, I'm back to, this will be my sixth time. I've tried eight times. It took me five times before I got my buckle. So there's a lot of people who are in the same boat, but we never get on and admit that we're in this boat to let them get in with us. And that's the thing is like, so, you know, I'm more than willing to admit weakness and fear and anxiety because I know we're not alone. My son deals with this and I keep telling him, you're not alone. You're not alone. So
This isn't just your story, Gordon. This is really our story. Mm, collectively, all of us, we have those fears and doubts and wonder and need to get back to reestablish that we once did or could or should. And I really appreciate and respect you coming out and vocalizing some of these internal thoughts so the rest of us can resonate with you and share with you and chart our own future and journeys that we want to take on. If you've got courage, then I've got courage. That's what made me think I could run 26, 50, or 100 miles the first time is because others could do it. If it was just, if I was the first guy to do it, 10 miles would have been max. That was it. But knowing that all these other people could figure it out gave me the courage and the confidence to go out and give it a go. And and you're doing that for us. So thank you.
And, there's some weird logic to that. You know, I want the buckle. I really have to have this buckle. But, I've learned that's not, if you put your joy in the piece of metal and not in everything you're going through till you get there, then you've lost so much. And I was doing that for years. I didn't finish Georgia Death Race. It was a failure. I got 40 miles at the Georgia Death Race. That's pretty remarkable, right? So it's like celebrate what you did, even if you cut it short quickly or if you thought you quit too soon. But we tend to dismiss the journey when we don't complete it. And I think that's so, I'm realizing that that's so misguided and it's so unfair to the people that in our lives who've gone with us on that journey, because I've got these four people who were my crew and they committed their weekend for me. And, I made the right decision, but I wanted this for them as much as I wanted it for me, because, I'm not used to accepting gratitude from kindness from strangers. I don't like it because I don't want to let them down. But it's like I had a great time with them, even though I only paced with one of them. We've got a bond now, whether I finished or not, right? And so why not celebrate that?
And they had fun too.
Yeah,
right. I was going to say, and if we had them on right now on this podcast and asked them, they would say they had the best time. They're prouder of you than if you would have finished with the buckle. The buckle is not the end all. It's the journey. It's the grit. It's the troubleshooting. It's all of that.
I love the atmosphere of ultras, whether I'm running in them or not. I love that. Mm-hmm. Everybody's got this mission. There's a family. There's people at the aid station. There's runners. There's crew. I love that feeling. I mean, I'll sleep in my truck two nights in the woods in the next couple of weeks to photograph a race and just watch these people do things. And it's that feeling of community and just shared struggle and victory and defeat. It's better than a drug, you know.
That buckle, though, we've got to be honest, it glows. And when the lights are out and you don't have a flashlight, you could actually take a buckle from a 100-mile run and you could find your way around the house. Because, you know, there's something unique and special about those things.
Yeah. There's a reason we keep trying to get them. They're worthy of the effort. So, yeah, it's some heavy stuff if you really stop and think about it. It's, you know, it's a simple sport, right? And I mean, we make it complex with all our gear, but it's a simple sport. We run from one place to the other and see what happens in the middle. And sometimes we overcomplicate it.
You're right. And the recipe is point A to point B with other people. That's mm-hmm. I mean, we overcomplicate it. And what makes it magical is those other people. And we've done training runs by ourselves, and you know, they're pretty cool. But when you do things with a group of people, all with a bib on, all moving the same direction, there's something very, very special about that and powerful about that. And to be in that group of like salmon going upstream, you're just moving along and you don't look left or right. You just move.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of big races in the nation. I mean, there's Hard Rock, Leadville, Western States, all that stuff. They're huge. But a lot of our local races mm-hmm. are 150, 200 people, the same people we see every year. And it's like a reunion because you know exactly when this guy's going to finish or when she's going to finish, or you know exactly what this person's going to struggle with because you've seen it every year and you know everybody for a first name. And it's like this little running caravan of family down the trail that we see every year. And that's, God, I love that. I mean, I don't see these people ever unless we're on the trail together, but I feel like I've seen them all week long, right? It's weird.
And then you see them in their regular civilian gear in the store and you go, I never recognized you without those shorts on.
Do I know you?
Hey, Gordon, this has been a great conversation. And just in the hour or so we've been talking, I want to run with you. I want to go out and I want to spend some time on the trail. I want you to show me around the Pinote 100. And it seems like we've already bonded. We're all really, all of us are the same. We enjoy the same values. Yeah. And you've really proven through this story of yours that we're all very, very similar, and we have common fears, common traits, and that's what I appreciate from your story. So thank you.
No, thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
So go out and do something hard.
Mas. It takes a team of people to finish a race. It takes a team of people to put together a podcast. And we want to thank some of those people.
Our Patreon supporters, we appreciate their participation.
We want to thank especially our business Patreon supporter, Doug Crumley at Crumley & Associates. You can find him at DougCrumleyJr.com. When you have the right financial advisor, life can be brilliant.
We'd like to thank our producer, Doug Mayer, and our associate producer, Ryan War.
And especially our social media expert, Yana Gibalova, who just joined us and is doing a wonderful job.